This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Big news this week as the Supreme Court ruled in favor of former college athletes against the NCAA. It was a unanimous decision, and some experts are saying this could be the beginning of the end for the NCAA. With us now to talk more about this decision and its impact is Samantha Horton, business and economics reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Welcome back, Samantha. Let's take a step back and talk about how all of this happened. How did this case get to the Supreme Court?
Yeah, thanks for having me. So it really went back to a former athlete, a West Virginia running back, Sean Alston, had filed a lawsuit claiming that, like, he had to take out extra aid for paying for college, like just extra educational costs that his scholarship maybe did not include. So that's where this case kind of started, was the idea of the limitations on educational benefits for students and how scholarships might not necessarily be covering all the costs that come with college.
Mm-hmm. And how long did it take to get to the Supreme Court? Has this case been going on for several years?
Yeah, so he filed, I believe, in 2014. So this has been a while, and it's obviously been going through the courts to eventually get to the Supreme Court ruling that we just had this week.
Mm-hmm. Well, I read an opinion piece recently in the Washington Post that mentioned this could revolutionize American sports. In what way would that happen? I think I lost some sound here. Samantha, are you there?
I'm here.
Yeah. So in what way would this revolutionize American sports if the NCAA has to start paying?
Yeah. So this is really focused. This was a narrow ruling on specifically educational benefits. So this is maybe something to think of. It is maybe it's providing scholarship that includes graduate aid for students. It kind of expands it a bit more. You know, it could be like, could you consider an iPad an educational benefit for a team? So it really expands that area. That's the part that's going to be a lot of conversation now, is figuring out those parameters. But I mean, this, the bigger thing now that everyone's focusing on is with the name, image, and likeness. And that's been a very big topic, especially we've heard a lot about it the past year and even a little bit prior to that, but really a lot this past year, especially too, with more student athletes talking about it. And that this opens the door for those, that is now kind of the next step that we're going to see. And with some states already taking action on the name, image, and likeness, with laws going into effect in July, which is next week, July 1st, that's going to be a very big, I think that's the next thing now that the NCAA is going to have to grapple with.
Mm-hmm. And by that, you mean using an athlete's name and image to promote things, they should be getting compensated for that?
Yeah, like a good example I might give is, let's say there's a basketball player who wants to have a basketball camp in the summer. Before, maybe they couldn't say it was like, well, I'll just use mine, but like Sam Horton, like myself, I could, if I was a basketball player, I couldn't say Sam Horton's basketball camp. Like I couldn't promote it as that, and in regards to then associating as a student, like college athlete. Now that's kind of some of the push there, is to maybe let students be able to profit off of their abilities.
Yeah, yeah. Well, were people involved in this case surprised by the outcome, or anyone you spoke with about this?
At least so far, no. Like I said a little bit earlier, I mean, this has been going through the courts for quite some time, and the Supreme Court's challenge, or the Supreme Court heard, was the final, like, hear, you know, people to hear about it. So, I mean, it's just reaffirmed the lower court's rulings. That's really what this came down to. So no one was really too surprised.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so when it comes to student athletes, when does this ruling go into effect for them? When will they be able to see these changes go into effect?
So the ruling just came out this week, so I can't necessarily give an exact like deadline that I can speak to right away, but I know now the big thing is now, and like I mentioned a little bit earlier, NCAA is going to have to set ideas of parameters of what is considered an educational benefit, because that could be very broad and very, a lot of interpretation there. And on top of that, then you start getting into conferences, might define what they see as educational benefit for their conference. And then it goes into even into then schools, even like, what is a school going to deem? Because I mean, there are things that have to be made careful of. Talking to some this past week, some of the concerns could be, you know, if, like I mentioned, iPads. If you gave iPads to a man, one of the men's teams, but didn't give it to a woman's team, you could start having a Title IX issue. So there's a lot of things that have to be figured out here in the next bit to figure out what to do next. So we'll keep an eye on it. I mean, next week's going to be the big week, though, with the name, image, likeness discussion, with some states going with that going into effect.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Samantha Horton, business reporter with Indiana Public Broadcasting. We'll definitely be back in touch on this topic. We're going to switch over now to the latest education news with education reporter Jeannie Lindsay. Jeannie, thank you for joining us. I know there's a new report that's been looking into the school choice program and whether it saves the state money. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. Always happy to talk about funding and finance. So this report is looking at Indiana's school choice program as a whole. So we're talking private school vouchers, we're talking public transfers, that open enrollment for students. And this is from Ball State University's Center for Business and Economic Research. And so they really set out to, they didn't know what they were going to find is what they were telling me. They really set out to look at the financial impact of what the school choice program is in terms of state funding. So this isn't looking at academics. This is just the financial picture.
Mm-hmm. And does this study highlight anything that wasn't apparent before?
Yeah, so there were a few interesting pieces of this brief, this analysis. One of the things that stands out is the amount of money that Indiana saved because of school choice. So it found that during the 2019-2020 school year, Indiana saved nearly $90 million. And so that was largely through private school vouchers, just because the nature of how those are funded, it's at a lower rate than the amount that public schools get per kid. So that was a huge chunk, was the private school voucher savings. But the other thing that it highlighted was that while most of the financial savings, were coming from private school voucher use, most of the kids in Indiana who use school choice to their benefit to decide where to go, they're making those decisions to move from a traditional public school to another public school. So we hear a lot about the concerns with vouchers and funding. And like I said, that's a huge chunk of the financial picture. But when it comes to where kids are actually going and using school choice to go, it's from public school to public school. The other thing that this report highlighted was that, you know, while Indiana saved, you know, this around $90 million through school choice, there's actually been a decline in education spending in the state when you adjust for inflation. So the report honestly said it best. So I've been using this line to describe it to people. But essentially, for every $1 that the state saved through school choice, the General Assembly has reduced education spending by another $7. Mm-hmm. So the state is spending less now on education than it was a decade ago. And that's important to remember, especially when you're talking about, you know, the financial impact of school choice. That $90 million sounds like a lot, but in the grand scheme of education funding, it really isn't a huge amount of money. So,
Well, do studies like this have any effect, do you think, on school choice or education spending and how it's thought about in Indiana?
Yeah, so this is actually one of the first really, you know, looks at Indiana specifically when it comes to school choice as a whole. So there have been studies, there's data out there about, you know, voucher programs, about charter schools, you know, there's in different communities, right? So some Indianapolis has talked a lot about this with the school choice and the systems of education in Indianapolis. But this is kind of one of the first, you know, looks at Indiana as a whole and the impact. So there are plans for future research. The researchers I talked to who worked on this say that they want to look at the academic effects of school choice in Indiana. And there have been some changes to school choice since, you know, the years that were included in this study. So there's definitely more data and analysis to be had. So we'll see what those say. But for now, I mean, it's hard to say what the effect will be. Indiana has been pretty committed to school choice. In fact, this year, the legislature expanded the private school voucher program and school choice. And so it'll be interesting. That was actually one of the things the researchers talked about as well, is that this voucher expansion that just happened may eliminate a lot of the savings that they found as a part of this study. So even though they were looking at data from 2019-2020, there's still a lot of factors to you know, continue examining and to look at further. So I could be wrong, but given Indiana's history with school choice, I don't see it changing drastically, especially with researchers, you know, that I talked to about this, describing this as sort of middle of the road in terms of how people are going to view this as a benefit or not to public schools or vouchers, et cetera. So I could be wrong, though. We'll see.
Well, another topic in education is the COVID-19 pandemic, and in particular, vaccines. Are you hearing anything from schools, what they're planning to do when it comes to students who are old enough to get the vaccine? Is there a push for it?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's something that school leaders have been, you know, around the state. I have not heard of any K-12 schools requiring vaccines or anything like that. But there certainly is a push to get, you know, staff and as many students as possible vaccinated before the beginning of next school year, which is honestly pretty soon for some school districts in the state, at the end of July or early August. So there has certainly been a lot of campaigning, a lot of publicity, a lot of, you know, hosting vaccine drives, partnering with people in the community to get students more vaccinated and to get those vaccines against COVID. Especially, you know, there are still people in schools, especially younger kids, but also certain individuals that for medical or other reasons simply cannot get vaccinated. So school leaders are really hoping to have as much in-person school as possible. And that means using this, you know, critical resource to fight against COVID vaccines and having as many people, students included, on board with that.
Right. Well, we have about a minute left. Has the pandemic opened the door to paying more attention to other vaccinations and whether kids are on schedule with their vaccines in general?
Yeah. And one thing I forgot to mention, I mean, up in Fort Wayne, the school district is actually partnering with a local nonprofit to do a sort of mini lottery to get more kids interested in vaccines. Essentially, if you get the vaccine, you get a chance to win $500, which is a pretty big deal for kids, especially if that's a nice number. But yeah, the CDC is also talking about how immunizations for other, you know, diseases has really gone down during the pandemic. So the CDC is putting out guidance and talking with folks about the importance of catching kids up on their regular immunizations that might be a little out of date for things like measles and whooping cough, because that's also a significant thing in schools. So there's definitely a big push to get more kids vaccinated against COVID, but also to catch them up on these immunizations, because fighting one pandemic is a lot harder when there are more diseases out there, and especially with, you know, the flu even. So they're really pushing to get that done.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us and giving us all the latest education news. Jeannie Lindsay, education reporter with Indiana Public Broadcasting. Just ahead, we'll talk about droughts and whether it's something we need to be concerned about here in the Midwest and Indiana. If you have any questions or comments for the show, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Soap. Back in 90 seconds, this is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Soab. As we hear more reports about droughts on the West Coast, how much of a danger do those pose in the Midwest and in Indiana? With us now to discuss more on the topic, we have Jason Lusk, distinguished professor and head of the Department of Agricultural Economics at Purdue University, and Molly Wollison, Midwest coordinator with NOAA's National Integrated Drought Information System. Welcome to you both. Molly, I'll start with you. When I think about a drought, I imagine dry, cracked dirt and scorching hot sun. Is that what a drought usually looks like?
You know, that's definitely a big part of it. And most typically, the first signs that someone will see that there are dry conditions and drought conditions. So that's definitely a part of it, especially as we're looking at agriculture, which, of course, is a huge part of Indiana's economy. But there's also other signs as well. For instance, if the drought progresses, you could see stream flows, surface water, like rivers and ponds look below normal than what you're typically used to seeing them at. But there's also the signs of drought that we might not see as often, which potentially could be ecosystem impacts and other species that might be affected that are not as obvious to us.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of species would those be?
You know, oftentimes, if we think about fish in streams and other ecosystems that are in the waters, they can be impacted if the stream flow is lower. There's also issues in lower water with having more water quality issues, and that can definitely affect those species that live in the water. But also wildlife, if there's not enough water for them to use in the typical fields that they might be in. That's sometimes when we see more wildlife coming to urban areas because there's not enough water for them where they typically would find it.
And Jason, you know, when it comes to Indiana, are we better off than places like California?
Well, I'm no meteorologist, so I'll defer the question of the weather to our counterpart here. But as best I know, you know, we're not under drought conditions in Indiana like we're experiencing in parts of the West at the moment. But it doesn't mean that, at least in terms of the economics, that it doesn't necessarily, you know, that even things that happen in other parts of the country can have impacts both for Indiana farmers and also Indiana food consumers.
And so can you tell us a little bit more about that? Like, how would what's happening on the West Coast impact Indiana with farmers and stuff?
Sure. Well, you know, let's talk about the consumers first, perhaps. You know, California is a big agricultural state. It's one of the largest producers of fruits and tree nuts, vegetables, a lot of dairy. So, you know, to the extent this drought continues, you know, we might expect to see that in ultimately higher, you know, fruit and vegetable prices. Almonds, some of those commodities are primarily avocados, come from California. So that's where we'd see it in the grocery store at some point, although, you know, growing season goes throughout the year. So we'll have to see how long it stays. On the farm side of things, you know, at least from a farmer's perspective, it's bad to say, but it can be good. If there's less supply being put on the market for, you know, of crops like corn, soybeans, hogs, although California isn't generally a big producer of those commodities, they do grow some, then, you know, that means, you know, less supply would mean higher prices, which is generally good if you have something to sell.
Well, Molly, when it comes to Indiana and drought, is there a history of drought in our state?
Yes, there definitely is a history of drought in Indiana. In this region, in the Midwest, you know, typically the biggest droughts that we've experienced were back in the earlier parts of the 1900s, the 1930s, the 1950s. However, as recent as 2012, we did have a very large drought that really took over the central United States, and Indiana definitely had a lot of negative impacts from that drought and the region in general. Overall, though, Indiana definitely, as I'm sure everyone's aware, has been dealing more with too much water than too little. However, even earlier this year, there were portions of northern Indiana that were actually pretty concerned about the conditions going into the growing season. So if the rain didn't fall, that actually did fall, thankfully, in the spring, drought definitely could have been a concern for Indiana this summer.
Well, it's interesting you're mentioning that there's a lot of water. So I wonder, Jason, is that impacting crops on the opposite side? I guess we assume droughts are bad, but is too much water going to have an impact?
It can, although I don't think, you know, really across the board in Indiana at the moment, it doesn't seem to be a problem. It you know, Molly mentioned the 2012 event when there was a drought. You can see that in the data in terms of things like corn yields, amount of corn that's produced bushels per acre, a real dip in 2012. And, you know, that's a direct result of that drought. It was a couple of years ago that actually water did caused some significant problems. Farmers couldn't get in the ground to plant. When they did, it got flooded. And, you know, that really reduced the output from that year. But at the moment, at least across the board in Indiana, things are looking pretty good weather-wise.
Well, Jason, is the stuff with agriculture, is it cyclical in nature? Like one year it's going to be a drought, one year it's going to be too much water. Is it just unpredictable?
Well, you know, the weather is hard to predict. So I'm sure Molly can tell us a little bit about variation. There are things that relate to, you know, El Nino type events, which are cyclical. But the one thing I will point out in terms of agriculture is that these are, you know, things that happen this year have effects many years out into the future. So again, let's come back to that 2012 drought that impacted corn prices. Well, corn gets used in ethanol and livestock feed. Those are the two primary uses of corn. Well, so corn prices got really high in 2012 because of that drought. That caused a livestock producers to cut back And particularly for animals like beef cattle, there's a long production life there, 3 years or so. So then you don't see those effects, those higher beef prices, until about 2 or 3 years later, when we saw really high, you know, prices at the grocery store. And that was a result of what happened 3 years prior because of weather events. So yes, these weather events do have long-lived effects often in agriculture because of these biological lags. You can't produce a new crop on a whim. It takes a growing season.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. And Molly, you know, similar question to you. Is the cyclical nature part of just the way things are with droughts?
Yes, it definitely is. And unfortunately, it's difficult to predict how a season will be at this point too far in advance. There is, you know, some skill that we're getting in terms of maybe a month or two in advance. We might be able to give some sort of idea what the summer might bring or another season. But it's definitely something that's difficult to predict at this point. And as Jason said, you know, there are some sources like El Nino or La Nina, where if those situations are present, it might mean one thing or another for our weather here in the Midwest. So sometimes those are used as predictors for whether we might have drought or wet issues coming up in the season to come. But it definitely is variable from one year to the next.
Right. And is there any sort of like technology that's able to better predict, or is it just weather will never be predictable?
Now, there's definitely a lot of research going on across, whether you're talking about a federal agency like NOAA or at universities at the academic level. There is a lot of research going on how to increase our ability to forecast these events. And there's definitely been improvements, but it's for sure an active area of research. And I think that there is some hope that we might be able to get a slightly longer lead time on these sort of events. However, weather is definitely very variable. And so there is a chance that our weather models just might not be able to get to what might be an ideal lead time for people, which of course would be maybe a year in advance, 6 months in advance, and for some people, potentially even longer. That is definitely going to be difficult.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'd love your questions and comments on the topic. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from, at 866-476-3881. When it comes to agriculture, obviously there's a need for water for crops, but there have been some genetically engineered crops able to withstand dry conditions. Is that the way of the future, Jason?
That's the hope. You know, a lot of those crops are not yet commercially available. But certainly there's research in the pipeline where we're trying to figure out crops that can be more drought resistant and in other cases, you know, more resistant to flooding. And, you know, what the challenge with things like biotechnology, frankly, has been consumer aversion and the high cost of regulation to get those things approved. So that's probably hindered some of the development in this area. But certainly if you just look at what scientists are working on, what's in the labs and even some of the research fields, so to speak, these are definitely things that are being worked on.
Mm-hmm. And Molly, is there a way to make sure we don't get into a drought in the first place, or is this just inevitable?
You know, it really is inevitable in terms of the fact that it's a natural hazard. And so there really is no way to prevent drought from happening. There's definitely going to be times when we experience drought across the Midwest. However, you know, there are ways that you can reduce the impact of drought. And so how you do this really will depend upon who you are, whether you're a farmer, a city water provider, or just an individual. You know, in terms of a farmer, you can try to start to plant more drought tolerant seeds, like Jason was talking about, or other ways that you can become a little bit more resilient to drought conditions. But it is going to depend on sort of who you are and what that will determine the actions that you can take.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jason, when it comes to agriculture,
I might add one thing.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, I was just going to add one thing there. You know, another way, you know, producers in a lot of parts of the country, you know, manage drought issues is irrigation. And there are parts of Indiana that irrigation is more prominent. But, you know, that comes with trade-offs, of course, and in different parts of the country that rely heavily on irrigation. I grew up in the Texas Panhandle, and a lot of irrigation there. But, you know, then you have problems of drawing down the aquifers and worrying about whether you have enough water into the future. But that is a way, if managed responsibly, to manage through drought-type conditions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was actually just about to ask you that. Like, what can farmers do that's something different? And so you're saying irrigation is one of the tools.
Sure. Yes, that's right.
Well, Molly, have things been getting worse over the years, or are they getting better when it comes to drought and understanding it?
Right. So overall in the Midwest, conditions have been getting wetter over the last few decades. That doesn't mean, though, we haven't had drought. Like I mentioned, we had the 2012 drought, and there have been smaller scale droughts that have been more localized for certain areas across the region. So overall, we have seen more precipitation. But really, we have seen these in more extreme events, meaning that we might have heavier rainfall events and longer periods of dry in between. So there's definitely movement towards a wetter climate, but with that extreme variability between wet too much and too dry. In terms of, you know, being able to be aware of drought, there's always new data and tools that are becoming available to monitor drought. And really, that is the key thing, especially as you're looking at, you know, states like Indiana trying to monitor drought, and others that are just wanting to keep an eye on conditions. There is better data out there to really kind of see when this might become an issue. So things have improved, and hopefully moving down the line, there'll be even more improvement in those monitoring tools.
Well, Jason, have you seen any changes over the years in how drought is talked about? Is it still sort of a mystery?
Sure. I mean, I think a couple of things I'll mention that have changed over time that at least help farmers manage this is insurance. So crop insurance is something that's really developed over the last, you know, 15, 20 years, so that when there is a drought, you know, farmers are able to at least recover some of those losses, because it's very common now for farmers to have crop insurance to protect against those losses. The other thing, this might sound a little strange, but is trade. That's what protects the consumer side of things. If we have a drought in our particular region in Indiana, we can import food and product from other parts of the country or other parts of the world. And if you look at trade and food and agriculture, that's something that also has changed and increased quite a bit over, you know, last several decades. And so that's also a risk, kind of a risk mitigation tool. You don't often think about it that way, but that's one of the things trade does for us, is enable us to withstand and to mitigate some of the drops that we might have in production if we get an adverse weather event.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have a few minutes left. I'm going to ask each of you to give us something our listeners can do in the long term to make sure we don't overuse our resources and things like water. I'll start with you, Molly. Is there anything that non-farmers can do?
Yeah, you know, I think in general, I think it's always good to use as little water as possible. You know, even if we aren't in a drought situation, Jason touched on it earlier in terms of, you know, our long-term water supply. And even though here in the Midwest, we do typically think of ourselves and we are a fairly water-rich region, that doesn't mean that there can't be issues down the line. So I do think it's important to try to conserve as much water as you can, being aware of what you are using as an individual. I also think, you know, trying to keep up on the conditions for drought is a good awareness. I think, you know, local news is definitely one way to do that. They are showing things like the U.S. Drought Monitor a little bit more these days. There's also, if you're interested in finding your local conditions, NIDAS, the program that I work for, we manage drought.gov. The drought.gov website, where you can really get local information about your drought conditions. So I definitely would use that as a resource if you're interested in knowing what your conditions are like and how it's impacting your area.
Oh, great. Thanks for sharing it. And Jason, any tips or suggestions?
Yeah, you know, to be honest, I don't, you know, our research suggests cajoling consumers and trying to convince them to, you know, adopt conservation measures are not terribly effective. So I'll just, you know, one of the things about water is it's a public good. It's something that our individual, you know, efforts often have very small effects. You often need something bigger. And in areas where there haven't been drought conditions, you know, pricing water differently if you use more, pricing water differently for your lawn than your house are policies that seem to have effects there. The other thing is that as a consumer, if you are doing something, if you buy less when prices increase because there's been a drought, that price increase is a signal to you that.
Mm-hmm. I think we lost you there. So, there yeah. You are. Okay.
Sorry, I was just saying that, yeah, the pricing signals that we see that when you see a higher price for a food product, you know, that's your signal to cut back. And that, mm-hmm. and one of those causes could be that, you know, there was less water and there's less availability than there was before. So just in your normal routine behavior of shopping and being judicious and prudent with your budget, you are responding to drought conditions.
All right. Well, thank you so much for all of your tips and information and knowledge. We really appreciate having you on with us today. Jason Lusk, Distinguished Professor and Head of the Department of Agricultural Economics at Purdue University, and Molly Wollazin, Midwest Coordinator with NOAA's National Integrated Drought Information System. Coming up, retail investors, investment apps, and younger demographics flocking to purchase stocks. What does it all mean? We'll find out. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. There have been some disruptions to the stock market, if you've heard of GameStop or AMC, and how those stocks went from nothing to skyrocketing in value after groups of people on the internet decided to go all in. No pun intended. Yes, All In is the name of the show. But there are also apps that folks are using that make it easier to buy and trade with no fees. Is that what's driving this trend? Well, we're joined now by Charles Terzinka, the James, and Virginia Kozat, Professor of Finance at Indiana University's Kelly School of Business. Welcome, Charles. Let's talk about retail investors. Who are they?
Well, thank you so much for having me on, Miriam. Retail investors are a growing part of the market. The software such as Robinhood and Webull, and to a certain extent the TD Waterhouse and the others, have drawn them in. Many of your listeners may have children and maybe themselves with the software they can put on their cell phones. And each one of these software vendors, they're actually brokers, will tell you that you can trade for free. In fact, Robinhood often gives you some companies for free. I mean, they'll give you a couple of 10 shares to trade. And they've drawn a lot of people in the stock market. No question about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not going to say which app I use because I don't want to give free publicity, but I've dabbled in some of those. And they seem very gamified. you know, they feel
yes,
very gamified.
Absolutely. That's the real trick. Right. So if you're used to a Bloomberg screen, No kid ever wants to work with a Bloomberg screen. It's actually, we have to train people how to do that. And much of the software up to then have been kind of, I mean, boring for people. But Robinhood has made it cool and fun.
Mm-hmm. And is that, do you think that's part of the problem? Like, is this creating, I'm just wondering, like, how social media addictions, and then it's like, maybe this is another version.
Well, yes, it is. It's both. It's two sides of the same coin. Okay, so there is, I've talked about the advantages, which is it gets people involved with the stock market. They think it's cool. They think it's fun. The disadvantage is just think about how Robinhood makes money. What are they doing? So they're doing all this for free, but Robinhood is worth, I mean, like $10 billion. So what, I mean, they're about to go public. So where are they making their money? What they're doing is they're taking all these orders from retail people and largely kids. They're putting them together and selling them to hedge funds so the hedge funds can trade against them.
Oh, wow.
That sale has made Robinhood I mailed you some numbers, and
right.
The numbers are from the FINRA's, what's called the 606 report, made Robinhood $600 million last year. The entire industry in selling retail orders has made $2.2 billion, which the only reason why people are willing to pay that $2.2 billion is that they're making more money. That is, they're probably the broker, the hedge funds on the other side are taking the Robinhood trades and trading against them. And of course, what Robinhood is doing is using psychology to try to draw people in. And people is for them online, you'll see they'll have, here's the hot stock right now. Okay, so basically, or the hot option. They make probably a little more money from options than they do from stock. Here's the way to make money. Here's the hot option. So you go into the trade. What Robinhood does is sell that trade to a hedge fund who takes the opposite position from you. And that is quite profitable because most, I mean, it's worth more than $2.2 billion.
Right.
We know that. We don't know exactly how profitable it is, but we know it's highly profitable.
Mm-hmm. Are they following some other model out there like that, or did they create their own?
I think the pandemic brought a group of people in who were gamers. I would guess mostly young people and probably young men, although a lot of women play games too. That's probably a little unfair because there's probably a lot of women in this too. When I survey my class, it's mostly men who are doing the using Robinhood and using Webull. But the women all know about it and they all trade. I think one of the evidences that we the studies in psychology show that men are more overconfident than women, so they probably trade more. But it's brought both of them in, and I see that as a good thing to bring them in. As long as they don't lose too much money, as long as they figure out that So I do think you're right that there's a group of people who are now investing in stocks that are challenging those people who are making, in their view, bad decisions, and that's a good thing. And it's nice that they're coordinating their trades through social media, Reddit, Wall Street Bets. Okay, absolutely. It's good to coordinate trades and to find out what other people are doing. Communication has always been so. One of the characteristics of financial centers has been very important to be in them. To talk to people, and what's happening with social media is that's been reduction of that. Mm-hmm. You know, social media has replaced that,
right? And there's also when it comes to cryptocurrency, that the whole Elon Musk and his tweets driving things up and down. That's been interesting.
Yeah,
to watch.
I mean, so basically, they're taking stocks and turning them into betting tools like Bitcoin is probably not the best thing for those stocks. But frankly, if they don't fall, I mean, the companies can reinvest. Cryptocurrency is really important for the economy, but not because of cryptocurrency, because of the blockchain in back of it. The blockchain is really important. It's going to change much of our lives. The cryptocurrency, I'm not so sure. But the blockchain, definitely. There were two inventions there with cryptocurrency. One was the currency itself, Bitcoin and all the rest of them, the various coins. And then the other was a blockchain. The blockchain was a real innovation. The cryptocurrency is just a betting thing. It's a highly biased view on my part, but you're not going to be buying your coffee with Bitcoins.
Yeah. Well, there's the story of the pizza that they were like, they bought it for 2 Bitcoins and now it was a $40,000 pizza.
Yeah, that's right. That's why you're not going to do it, right? I would never pay Bitcoins in that. About to 2010, I tried to buy some Bitcoins, didn't know how to do it. I was going to buy 100 of them. It was like $6 a piece then. But I didn't know how to do it. All the exchanges weren't any exchanges up. And I spent some time trying to figure out. I never did it. I would have been one of the best investments of my life. But
right. Well, there's other cryptos out there if you still feel like you want to gamble.
Yeah.
Well, do you think we're going to see more of these apps, like, for example, like Robinhood popping up and changing Wall Street at all?
I wonder. I mean, there's only so many orders you can sell. Robinhood's been very good at accumulating the orders and selling it to hedge funds. They've been very good at designing the software to bring people in. They've also been good at regulatory filings. And I mean, I interviewed at the SEC for a senior position a few years ago, and all the attorneys who interviewed me were top attorneys at the SEC. They're all working for Robinhood now. Wow. So, So Robinhood is I mean, the government's going after these companies. I don't know anything personally. I don't know anything specifically, but if you read the press, it appears to be. It doesn't surprise me. And I think the Gensler has made a statement about this on how markets are compensated. And I think he's specifically talking about the payment for order flows. So keep posted about what the government does to this. And of course, what this will mean is it'll be harder to start another Robinhood, right? Because you're going to need to hire the attorneys. And that's unfortunate. That is really unfortunate. Because I think Robinhood could use a lot of competition.
Yeah, I mean, competition makes things better. So absolutely. I guess we'll wait and see what happens. Yep. Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us, Charles Terzinka, the James and Virginia Cozad Professor of Finance at Indiana University's Kelly School of Business. It was a pleasure.
Hey, Miriam, it's been fun. And to people listening, got to get out there and participate in the market.
Yes, indeed. And I'd love to have you back on again. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yace, and Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Chris Flood engineered the show today. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Join us Monday as we talk about art therapy. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.